It was a classy restaurant. Violins played and a waiter flapped out her napkin and laid it in her lap. Even called her madam, which was a bloody cut above. Eddie beamed at her, teeth polished and breath like mint. His handsomeness shot straight to her knickers. He pushed two boxes across the table. "Open them," he said, "so you know I'm serious about you." Peg felt other tables looking at her. She opened the larger box and lifted out an orange. It was the most perfect orange. She closed her eyes and smelt it. Could have bitten into it there and then, and when she heard someone laugh, it almost ruined the moment. "Next," he said. And she was prepared to feign delight at the little box. But when she opened the lid, the brooch was beautiful. So she didn't have to. Eddie took it from her hand and held it up to the light. "Cameo is Shell. Did you know that?" "Of course I did," said Peg, even though she didn't. "I didn't," he said, and he held the brooch to his ear. "Can you hear the sea?" she said. He shook his head. "No, just a little voice," he said, screwing up his face. "What's it say?" "Let's go back to yours." And Eddie laughed. Peg didn't laugh. "We can't though, Eddie. I told you that. I thought we were going to a hotel." "It was a brooch or a room," he said. "And I thought you'd like the brooch." Peg drank past the borders of romantic and ended up against a wall under a railway arch. It was a monochrome night and shards of moonlight scattered across black cobbles and highlighted glimpses of Peg's white flesh. Her American soldier was kissing her hard and he'd promised her a room but got her a brooch instead, and there they were, up against a wall with a cheap bunch of flowers at her feet. He was fumbling around looking for the Western Front and she said he'd have to go further south to find it. "There we go," she said, and he groaned. She liked the way he said, "baby," liked the way he said, "I've never met a girl like you, Peg," liked the way he fucked her. But all she could think of was that he'd promised her a room. And she tried to push the thought aside, but the more he kept pounding her into the wall, the more that room came back to taunt her. "You promised me a room," she said. I know," he said, all busy, like, "next time," he said. "I don't do next time," she suddenly said, and dropped her leg. "Stop," she said, "I'm done," and she tugged on his rich boy hair. "Jeez, Peg, what you doing?" "I said stop." A train passed overhead and the stone shook. Peg pulled down her skirt and took off across the road. "Peggy," her name echoed across the bricks, the sound of his footsteps after her. "Why can't we go to yours?" he said. "You married or something?" "Nah, I'm not married or something. I live above a pub, where I work. I've told you that 100 times before. You promised me a room, and you've suddenly gone cheap. That brooch wasn't." "Call me when you book the sheets, Eddie. But none of this one step away from whore. It's too close." She walked down to the canal with a hard-as-nails look across her face, and even the rats steered clear. The bench was empty, and she sat down and lit a cigarette. A drunk stumbled along the towpath and was about to speak to her, but she said, "Don't you fucking dare," and her voice was like a blade, so he didn't. She could handle herself, always had, and the city never frightened her, especially at night. The canal drew the lonely and the dreamers, and in that moment she was both. She wanted out of here. An American boy was her out of here. California, new world, new life. She was cupping that dream in both hands, careful not to spill not even a drop. She rubbed her foot. She had the start of a bunion like her mum. The woman had had big bloody chestnuts on the side of her feet. God help her if the similarity was working its way up. She lit a match and looked at her watch. 1:10. Out of the darkness, that familiar face.
"Come here often," said Cress.
"We're making a habit of this," she said.
"Want to go home?"
"Come on then." And he pulled her up and she towered over him. Cressy had once told her that he dreamt of being a jockey on account of his size, but had ended up at the docks, and just once, he'd said, just once, he'd have liked to have gone on one of them boats. "Don't have to travel the world to be worldly," she'd said.
"You think I'm worldly?"
"Now I'm worldlier. It's what's in here that counts." And she pointed to his stomach. "Guts is where we love from," she said. They climbed the steps back up to the street.
"You love this Yankee fella?" he asked,
but Peg didn't answer.
"Come on, girl, you ain't a kid no more."
Peg stopped and slipped on her shoes.
"Yeah, I love him. Like I'd die without him. Blimey, you got it bad. So don't ask." "You tell him stuff," said Chris. I'll tell him nothing. Tell him something. Words, Peg. He might not be here forever. You get told stuff. Not so much. But words are gold dust to a decrepit old git like me. You're not decrepit, she said, and opened her handbag. Here, have an orange.
Well, look at that, he said,
and held it up against the black sky.
You know how this came into the world, Peg?
A couple of navels on a dirty weekend, he laughed.
This here is the love child of a mandarin and a pomelo.
What in fuck's name's a pomelo?
Citrus maxima. You seen one?
Ah, just read about it.
It's like a large grapefruit with thick skin and a lot of pith.
Bit like coal, then, she said, as the dark outline of the pub came into sight.
When you seeing him again?
Day after tomorrow.
Well, you tell him stuff, Peg. You give him hope.
A week after the Oltrano district of Florence had been liberated, Ulysses and Darn Lee were in the Boboli Gardens behind the Pitti Palace, where they'd been managing a supply convoy all morning. Darn Lee was standing on a wall overlooking the city. The sound of gunfire ricocheted across the Arno, and smoke rose from the streets below. Ulysses was hidden in a bush, gunsight trained on the Belvedere fort, where a fascist sniper had caused havoc all morning. You still okay with this, sir?
Yes, yes, said Darn Lee. I die here, I die happy. Okay if I smoke?
Whatever you like. You're a mere lure.
I am a lure, said Darn Lee. I'm a lure unto myself.
And he laughed and struck a match.
This view, he said. Miracle of right time, right place. Luce intellettuo piena d'amore.
What's that mean, sir?
Light of the mind, full of love.
Nice,
isn't it?
One of yours, sir?
No, Dante. The belief that a combination of intellect and beauty can make the world a better place.
You see our sniper yet? Not yet, sir, said Ulysses, wiping sweat out of his eye. Probably having lunch.
Probably,
said Darnley, blowing out a long stream of smoke.
He said, and there, in the centre, representing the glory of the city itself.
What are you pointing at, sir?
The cathedral. Brunelleschi's dome, ushering in the great period of Renaissance humanism. Built in majesty so those seated below it could receive God. And yet, first and foremost, it's a testament to the order and beauty of the universe. A universe that is responsive in non-judgmental terms and in which mankind has a place. Man as the measure of all things. And the poets and artists ran with that conviction. Perspective composition arranged around the human figure. The square and the circle became the bedrock of 15th century architecture. And in Vitruvian spirit, Leonardo placed man inside both. Science and theology living side-by-side temps, the gift of intellect and artistic achievement as God-given as faith. What a moment for those maverick minds to have come together. Yes, it was short-lived, but so what? The explosion of energy from that time destroyed myths and superstitions and revealed the heavens just as they were, subject to decay and mutability, just like us.
Darnley flicked away the cigarette. He said,
I was thinking. After the war, we could...
We don't do after, do we, sir?
Oh, fuck, God, no. Of course we don't. Sorry. It's his view.
It makes me dream. More rage, sir, please.
More rage?
Yes, please, said Ulysses. And a lot more volume. Wave your arms around.
Like this?
That's perfect, said Ulysses. Ah, here we go. I see him.
My life in your hands, Temps.
Always, sir. And he held his breath. He lined the man up in his sight, and the trigger moved easily. The jarring crack of a gunshot rang out, and in the distance a body fell from the tower, then a Pennino a moment later. Darnley cheered and jumped down from the wall. Ulysses crawled out from the bush and brushed himself down. Darnley said,
Do you notice a smell, Temps?
I do, sir. Death and unwashed bodies, I'd say.
That's precise,
said Darnley, as they headed up towards Neptune's fountain. And a touch of the usual, said Ulysses.
When they got to the fountain, a group of women were scrubbing their children and clothes in the same fetid water. Darnley shook his head.
Jesus Christ, he said. Niccolo di Raffaello di Niccolo de Pericoli would turn in his grave.
Oh, I doubt he'd be able to move, sir, once they'd got his name in.
It physically pains me, Ulysses, he said, to see these gardens like this.
I know it does, sir.
You can see that?
I can.
Don't they care?
It's hard to care if you don't have bread, sir. Or water. Darnley sighed. Come on, Alexander, St. John Darnley. Let's find your jeep and get you back. The stench of squalor hit them as they stepped down into the courtyard. The place was crawling like a Naples slum, thousands of traumatized people with only one source of water, as if emerging from a siege. Ulysses and Darnley struggled through the murk towards the supply convoy. To their left, an argument erupted over the allocation of flour. Sheets and clothing hung down from the upper balconies of the palace, and under the portico, away from the sun, people sprawled across mattresses, holding tight to meager belongings. Makeshift charcoal stoves were firing up, and the air was acrid and fumy. These were the people who had once lived in the vicinity of the River Arno, forced to evacuate their homes before the retreating German army blew up the bridges. All except the one, that is. The Ponte Vecchio was saved by a sentimental Führer who'd visited the city in 38 and formed an attachment to the famous landmark. Darnley said it proved the man had fucking awful taste. So had invading Poland, added Ulysses. Let's go, sir, shouted Ulysses. Darnley got in the jeep, and they drove into the heat, leaving behind the grand facade of the former ducal seat. At the bottom of the slope along the Via Guicciardini, rubble 30 feet high blocked access to the Ponte Vecchio. Ulysses turned the jeep around and headed west. The stink of broken sewers and seeping gas pipes broiled under an August sun. The air shimmered like liquid. They only got as far as Piazza del Carmine when Darnley suddenly shouted, "Stop the car!"
"Sir?"
"Stop the car," repeated Darnley. Crowds of returning Florentines passed by, dragging handcarts.
"What is it, sir?"
"You need to spend time in this city, Temps. I promised Miss Skinner, didn't I? Go on, out you get. But back before nightfall." There was no negotiation. Ulysses grabbed his rifle and got out the jeep, and Darnley shifted behind the wheel. Ulysses watched him drive away, unsure what had just taken place. He unscrewed his canteen and drank. The sun was fierce overhead. The wide expanse of the piazza offered no shade, and the stones were baked white. Ulysses backed away from the church and followed a cyclist, making slow progress towards a street entirely in shadow. He felt invigorated by the cool and by the hours of freedom ahead. Men continued to shake his hand as if he were the sole liberator of their city, and women kissed him, left marks of bright lips across his cheeks, but he didn't mind. No one back home could understand what occupation did to a people. The deprivation of body and soul. The daily choice to survive, but at what cost, and sometimes at what cost to others. He stood back and saluted as Allied tanks passed. A soldier gestured that he was a wanker. He laughed. That was the least of his problems. The street brought him to the corner of a tree-lined square dominated at the far end by a church. He moved through a crowd that had gathered outside a cafe, and the bells rang out. He settled on a bench in the shade near a fountain, half expecting to hear a familiar gurgle, but the city's water supply had long been cut. He lit a cigarette and watched the path of swifts through the campanile, across the terracotta dome, that perfect complement to the azure sky. A dog howled. A cyclist passed by. An overwhelming feeling that something bad had happened there, and it was that something other that ratcheted up the tension. He noticed a group of people gesturing wildly. He stood up and joined them, followed the path of their gaze to a shutter swinging above. Beyond the shutter, a lone dark figure. It could have been a statue, except for the slight swing of the man's arm to steady his balance. He was inching himself down the roof until the drop came into sight, at which point he froze. The man's hat took off on the breeze and made a spiraling descent. It took no effort at all for Ulysses to stretch out his hand and catch the dark grey Borsellino pinch-front fedora. He rushed forwards, surprised to find the door to the building locked. He tried each of the neighbouring buildings in turn until a door gave way and led him into an ancient stone vestibule. He ran up the stairs two at a time and set in motion a sequence of events that the locals would gladly recapitulate in the coming days. There would be many versions of the stairwell dash that would be told later in the café, but it was Signor and Signora Mimi, an amorous couple in their early 60s, only recently returned to their top-floor apartment, who actually opened the door to the soldato and were thus granted special dispensation to tell the story as it was, without interruption or embellishment by the many unreliable narrators who frequented the square. "He was banging on our door," they said in unison. "But not like when the Germans arrived," added the signora. "Could you demonstrate?" suggested the priest, and she made a fist and began banging on the counter. Everybody agreed that the tone was not angry, but had a certain consideration to it. "Oh, yes," said Signora Mimi. "He was very polite. He wiped his boots on our mat. He said, buongiorno, but that was the extent of his Italian. He was a kind-looking soldier with lovely eyebrows and dimples. He kept pointing his finger upwards, trying to get us to understand. He was sweating. We had no water, so we offered him a large glass of wine, which he drank straight down. We led him into the kitchen, and when he saw the ladder, he began to climb up to the terrace, where my husband grows two fig trees and collects rainwater. But there has been no rain for weeks, and the fig trees are dead." "Mine too," said the butcher. It was at this point both Signor and Signora Mimi confessed to the gathering that they lost sight of the soldier when he moved from the ladder to the roof. "Weren't you interested?" the greengrocer asked. "No," they said. "We wanted to make love." So there was Ulysses, on the roof with a nice little wine buzz, 100 feet up, with a man he didn't know, precariously close to the edge, and an easy target for the most incompetent sniper. "Signore," said Ulysses, "I seem to have your hat." And Ulysses held out the fedora in a casual and unthreatening manner. As an opening gambit, he thought, it would establish whether the man could A, speak, and B, understand English. The resultant silence proved he could do neither. Ulysses left the hat by the terrace and inched his way down the shallow slope. The gasps from below were audible. As Ulysses drew near, he could see that the man was in his 50s, wearing a suit and tie of all things, dressed for his funeral. "I wonder what's brought you up here," he thought. And he smiled, because everyone told him he had the most disarming smile. Down below, Michele, the cafe owner, had miraculously acquired a pair of binoculars and was reporting the situation to the eager crowd that was growing by the minute. "He's smiling," he said. "Arturo? No, the soldier. Now he's lighting a cigarette." "Arturo? Madonna mia, the soldier!" And Michele gesticulated wildly and lowered the binoculars. On the roof, Ulysses brought the cigarette to his mouth and assessed the situation. It was a beautiful summer's afternoon. The sun was at his back, casting a web of brilliance across the rooftops, and the light fell pink across the Bellasquadro Tower, and the Duomo and the hills shimmered in haze. He was flooded with gratitude. If life was to end there, then so be it. He felt his father by his side, and his father's father. He was earth to a long line of tempers, all mild-mannered, decent men, who'd never asked for much except good odds once in a while. He wondered if the name had actually derived from Templar, the warrior priest, fighting in the name of faith and love, however misguided. There were consequences to actions, of course. These were his thoughts before he dislodged a tile that sent him hurtling into space. The crowd below gasped.
"Oh, mio Dio!"
shouted Michele's wife, Julia.
"Oh, mio Dio!"
The priest crossed himself multiple times, and a stranger to the area, who had fascist tendencies, crossed his fingers and hoped for the worst. The predicament as far as Ulysses could see, wasn't that he was half on and half off the roof, but that his gun barrel was caught in the guttering. He was wedged in a rather uncomfortable position, testicles not known for their weight-bearing capacity. Ulysses turned towards the man and, still optimistic that a conversation without commonality of language was possible, said, "Now listen to me, signore," and went on to explain that he'd been in a similar situation once before, and apart from the physical discomfort, which was severe, he was still hopeful for a positive outcome. If only, his voice at this point was calm and measured, with not an ounce of pleading, if only you could bend down and release the barrel of the gun. The signore frowned. The gun. Ulysses' eyes motioned to the gun. Bang, bang. All that was necessary, he said, was a small movement, a lean forwards, a slight crouch, and an outstretched hand, an action that demanded nothing more than a bodily counterbalance, no more than you would do, say, to pull a child out of a pond. Nothing more. Down below, Michele explained to the crowd, "The soldiers' gun barrels caught in the guttering." A murmur of disbelief rose. "And they seem to be talking," said Michele.
"How can they be talking?" said the elderly Contessa. "Arturo doesn't speak English, the soldier doesn't speak Italian. This is a disaster. Do something, idiot man."
Michele stepped forward and in his strong accent shouted, "Oi! Arturo! The gun barrel stuck. You have to release the gun from the guttering." The crowd below started to shout, "Release the gun! Release the gun! Release the gun!" Arturo bent down. "No! Don't close your eyes," said Ulysses. Arturo looked at him. "That's it. See, see, that's it. Almost there. Almost."
"He's released the gun!" shouted Michele from below.
The crowd cheered and clapped.
"Well done, Arturo!"
they shouted, and started to chant his name. Arturo looked down at them, confused. It was death he'd been seeking, not acclaim. Ulysses gave him a thumbs up before a quick assessment of his next move. He found that his body weight favoured the roof considerably more than the drop, and he began to listen to the building, to its hardened solidity, to the centuries-old terracotta tiles, to the guttering, to the lives once lived within. And in this act of listening was a simple question. Can I trust you? It was a question he asked silently of everyone within minutes of an encounter. Peggy? Cruel, but trustworthy. Evelyn Skinner? Trustworthy. Captain Darnley? I'd follow him to hell. He watched an insect crawl across his arm and thought that was as good an answer as he was likely to get, and he began to swing his leg and the guttering shook, backwards and forwards until the impetus of motion had generated enough energy for him to push off, suspended momentarily between roof and sky. And when he landed, it was just a slight wobble backwards that evoked a scream from the priest below. But it was mainly traction that he felt beneath his boot. Beautiful resistance. He brushed himself down, readjusted his balls, and a crescendo of applause rose from below. At this point, three buildings along, the Mimis looked out of the window, completely unaware of the drama that had played out above them, as they'd gone at it on the sofa like teenagers. "Come on, Arturo," said Ulysses. "It's over." And he offered his arm, and Arturo took it, and they walked back up the roof together, to the hat, to the small terrace, to the quiet home below. The euphoria of cheating death gave way to a weary calm, and Ulysses left Arturo at the kitchen table and went to find a bathroom. The toilet gave off a strong smell of ammonia, which he regretted adding to. Out in the hallway, the first room on the left was a bedroom. Ulysses lay down on the bed, and the heavily embroidered eiderdown was cool and enticing. Above him was a fresco, something classical, not religious, and he recognized the acanthus leaves that Darnley had pointed out to him over the months, the trompe-l'oeil effect of cornices, an open sky and birds in flight. A breeze blew and the shutters creaked. He heard the man in the kitchen and it was a sad, lonely sound. Three more bedrooms led off from the hallway, two overlooking the church and square, the other a cortile in the back. They shared the same simplicity of decor, a luxurious ease of taste and style. Frescoes on the ceiling, but only curved lines and clusters of leaves, blue and white or white and pink, washed out by age or a skillful brush. In the living room, two walls of books insulated the room, and rugs were cast across the terracotta floor. An air of conviviality was enhanced by a couple of large sofas, orange in the fading light. No antimacassars, no heavy wooden chairs that were all too familiar in Florentine homes. Paintings cluttered the walls, images of fruit and working kitchen tables scattered ingredients in various states of decomposition, domestic ordinary scenes he could have placed his mother in. He sat at the desk behind a typewriter and typed his name over and over, and the keys made a heavy, percussive sound in the quiet. He picked up the book next to the typewriter, looked at the dense text and old photographs of paintings, Il Restauro dei Dipinti, large on the cover. He flicked through the pages and stopped at one of the images. In the doorway to the kitchen, he held the pages of the book open and said, I saw it. Arturo turned.
La deposizione del pontormo?
Yep, said Ulysses. Saw it. And his finger moved from eye to picture to window.
Dove l'ha visto?
Said Arturo. South of here, said Ulysses, and he pulled up a chair and dropped his pack on the floor. He placed the book between them and said,
It's about grief.
Oldest story in the world. And he placed his hand on Arturo's arm. He said, They're trying to make sense of something they can't make sense of. People captured in the exact moment Jesus comes off the cross. And in that moment is energy and emotion. It's a bit like stopping a dance, and all you're left with is the silence and the sorrow. And your pulse races. Arturo stared at him. Eventually he stood up, pushed aside his chair and crouched under the table. He removed a couple of floor tiles to reveal the dark maw of a cubbyhole, a hidden pantry that, for a year, had sustained life. He pulled out a bottle of wine, a candle, and a nub of cheese. What a feast, said Ulysses, and he reached round and retrieved a tin of ham from his pack and placed it on the table. That's when Arturo began to cry. It's only ham, said Ulysses. And for 2 hours the wine was poured, the cheese cut, and the two men talked. Of what? Who knows? Of love? Of war? Of the past? And they listened with hearts instead of ears, and in the candlelit kitchen 3 floors up in an old palazzo, death was put on hold. For another night, or day, or week, or year. Ulysses left as dusk was beginning to settle across the square. The heavy thump of the door behind him set a dog howling. The striking facade of the church glowed, and the last of the swifts made a desperate lunge at play. There were a few stragglers aimlessly wandering, but mostly the square was emptying before dark. He'd need to be sharpish to get back to camp before curfew, and he ran across the square instead of turning left and found himself down by the river. The water was low and a squadron of mosquitoes hovered above it, cruising for blood. The old buildings that had once overhung the river had all gone. The balconies, arches, towers were now a giant pile of shattered masonry that littered the embankment or had found settlement on the riverbed. A bailey bridge under construction crossed the stricken stumps of the Ponte Santa Trinita, and the occasional pop of sniper fire north of the city kept him close to the wall in the darkest shadows. On the opposite shore, German tanks drove down onto the Lungarno, their bulk in the twilight like elephants at a waterhole, and the flare of German cigarettes in German mouths. It shouldn't have been beautiful, but it was, daringly so. He stepped back into the dark streets and headed west until he came to the vast space of Piazza del Carmine again, then continued west until the Boboli Gardens were back on his left. If they stayed on his left, he knew he would eventually arrive at the Porta Romana and an Allied unit and the slow road home. He heard the sound of English vowels up ahead and quickened his pace. They were battalion stragglers coming from a brothel. In safety in numbers, they traversed the checkpoint and the threat of court-martial and staggered up towards the villa where they were billeted. The night became fragrant and flowers from lime trees spilled over the wall, the scent draped across them and filled the space between them, dizzied them like bees. Darnley was waiting in the orchard by Ulysses' tent. The familiar stooped outline, the furtive rise of cigarette to mouth, the furrowed brow lit by the cold blue light of the moon. Darnley turned at the sound of his footsteps. "Nice hat, Temps," he said. "Thanks, sir." And Ulysses took it off and showed him. Darnley motioned for him to follow, and they walked to the edge of the trees to the remotest part of the garden, away from ears. Darnley said, "We're leaving."
"What?"
"Tomorrow. Back over to the Adriatic. Fifth Army stays put."
"Fuck."
"Indeed. All a bit sudden. You all right, sir?"
"No,
not really." And Darnley ran his hand around the hatband.
"I don't know," he said. "Something's not right. Is it cooler tonight, or is it me?"
"Bit cooler, sir," said Ulysses, lying.
"Thought so," said Darnley.
And he placed the Borsellino back on Ulysses' head. "I saved a man's life this afternoon, sir."
"You save mine every single day, Thames."
"You're heading in?" "In a bit, sir."
"Night then, Temps."
And Darnley, without thinking, took his leave Italian style. There was a pause, however, before the second kiss, and in that intimate space was a 1937 Brunello di Montalcino, decanted. And in that intimate space was something unvoiced. "No more, sir, and war is over." "You look very handsome," said Darnley, before disappearing through the trees, back up to the villa. The following day, on 11th of August, La Campana del Popolo in the Palazzo Vecchio chimed continuously, encouraging every other bell in Florence to do the same. The sound chased the Germans up into Fiesole and into the surrounding hills. At the modest albergo, Evelyn Skinner, Margaret someone, and the Signore stood on the terrace listening.
"Gloria. Gloriosus. Glorious," pronounced Evelyn.
Margaret said nothing, because she was still smarting over Pontormo's deposition and had moved into the annex the night before into a somewhat smaller and cooler room.
"Liberazione," said the proprietor. "In more ways than one," thought Evelyn.
She went with him to search for bottles of Frizzantino, and the proprietor, overcome by the emotion of the morning, attempted to kiss Evelyn in the old cowshed. "Not a euphemism," she would one day say. "Oh, what the hell," she thought, and offered her mouth. He was surprisingly tender, but the kiss asserted her view that men were still not for her, and after she thanked him in perfect Italian, confirming that the kiss would be their first and last, she turned around, only to see Margaret someone standing in the light dappled doorway, mouth pinched as if a wasp had unwittingly found entry.
"How could you?" whispered Margaret. "Get a grip," said Evelyn, passing her swiftly and striding towards the terrace.
The proprietor popped the cork and narrowly missed an unsuspecting swallow. Evelyn toasted loudly,
"To freedom and all who sail in her."
The bells guided Darnley and Ulysses out of the city as if they were kings. Darnley asked Ulysses to pull over to a stretch of road that offered the most spectacular views, and he stood up and named every church and monument he could see. Ulysses watched him salute the city, his longest, most committed relationship to anything. Danny said, "Come on, Temps, let's go." And the jeep pulled away and rejoined the convoy heading east. The sun was high and the shadows spare. The smell was of dust and lime flowers and men. Darnley gibbering on about an obscure sculptor whose work had been attributed to someone else. Ulysses said, "I think you're one of the best men I know, sir." "The best man ever, sir." Darnley turned to him and smiled. Click. Caught forever. Captain Darnley was killed in action on 9th of September 1944 at Coriano Ridge, 3 days short of his 31st birthday. Ulysses became quiet that day. He wouldn't talk about him for years.